Hello there. Today is Wednesday, February 22nd. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump condemns a rise in anti-Semitism.
To fight bigotry, intolerance, and hatred in all of its very ugly forms.
Some Jewish groups, though, say the president doesn't go far enough. Where in the world is traffic the worst? More states in America looking to enact death with dignity laws. Also ahead, singer Selena Gomez is reinventing her career after a rough time. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump has condemned a recent surge in anti-Semitic threats across the country, saying they are going to stop.
The anti-Semitic threats targeting our Jewish community and community centers are horrible and are painful and a very sad reminder of the work that still must be done to root out hate and prejudice and evil.
Trump's remarks were made during a visit Tuesday to the new National Museum of African American History and Culture on the National Mall. The president's comments come one day after the Anti-Defamation League reported at least 10 Jewish community centers in multiple states had received bomb threats on Monday, the fourth string of such threats since the beginning of the year. And last weekend, the graves of more than 170 Jews were vandalized at a cemetery in Missouri. The ADL and Trump's opponent in last November's election, Democrat Hillary Clinton, called on Trump to take a stronger stand against anti-Semitism. VOA White House correspondent Bill Gallo talks about it with Ira Melman about the growing pressure on the president.
Well, he had been under increasing pressure, and that sort of had ramped up in the last day or two. Hillary Clinton, his election rival, of course, said in a tweet this morning that the threats against Jewish community centers and the desecration online attacks are troubling. They need to be stopped. Everyone must speak out, starting with President Trump. Ivanka Trump, Donald Trump's daughter actually tweeted yesterday that America is a nation built on the principle of religious tolerance. We must protect our houses of worship and religious centers. Now, that tweet actually stood out as being something that Donald Trump had not done yet. He hadn't used that kind of language. So there was pressure. Several Jewish groups had been calling on him to make these statements, and so that's apparently why he followed through.
Well, this follows, I guess we could call it a confrontation at a news conference that was held last week.
Right, yeah. President Trump was asked about this at a press conference last week by a Jewish reporter, and Trump responded sort of harshly, some said. And in fact, he called the reporter a liar. Here's the audio from that exchange.
What we are concerned about, and what we haven't really heard being addressed, is an uptick in anti-Semitism and how the government is planning to take care of it. There's been a report out that 48 bomb threats have been made against Jewish centers all across the country in the last couple of weeks. There are people who are committing anti-Semitic acts or threatening to.
You see, he said he's going to ask a very simple, easy question. And it's not. It's not. Not a simple question. Not a fair question. Okay, sit down. I understand the rest of your question. So here's the story, folks. Number one, I am the least anti-Semitic person that you've ever seen in your entire life. Number two, racism, the least racist person. In fact, we did very well relative to other people running as a Republican. Quiet, quiet, quiet. See, he lied about he was going to get up and ask a very straight, simple question. So, it's welcome to the world of the media. But let me just tell you something that I hate the charge. I find it repulsive. I hate even the question because people that know me, and you heard the Prime Minister, you heard Netanyahu yesterday. Did you hear him, Bibi? He said, I've known Donald Trump for a long time. And then he said, forget it. So you should take that instead of having to get up and ask a very insulting question like that.
So go ahead. What led to that type of reaction from the President of the United States?
Yeah, well, this isn't the first time this kind of thing has happened. During the campaign, there were several such exchanges. I think that possibly Donald Trump may be perceiving some of these questions as an attack or an attack on some of his supporters. And, for instance, a few days earlier, Trump was asked about the same issue at a press conference with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel. He responded by bragging about the size of his Electoral College victory. So it's really hard to say why he does it, but today, obviously, a very clear statement on condemning these instances.
While following the president's statement, the Anti-Defamation League and the Anne Frank Center for Mutual Respect issued a scathing response, likening it to putting a Band-Aid on a cancer patient, saying the president has had chance after chance to speak out and shouldn't be praised for finally saying the right thing. Meanwhile, the ADL says no explosives were found at the centers and described the reported threats as non-credible. The FBI is joining the Justice Department in investigating the incidents. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security on Tuesday issued two new memos outlining the implementation of President Trump's executive orders to stop illegal immigration while deporting undocumented immigrants out of the United States. White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer outlined the orders during his daily press briefing.
The memo regarding the executive order Border Security and Immigration Enforcement Improvements outlines the steps that DHS will take to secure the nation's southern border, prevent further illegal immigration, and to repatriate illegal immigrants swiftly, consistently, and humanely. This includes immediately identifying and allocating all sources of available funding for the planning, design, construction, and maintenance of a wall along our southern border, and hiring of additional personnel, including 5,000 additional CBP border agents.
Immigrants' rights advocates say new immigration policies are intent on inflicting cruelty on millions of immigrant families across the country. The memos, first leaked to the media on Friday, have only one exception. The Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, known as DACA recipients, immigrants who came to the U.S. at a young age and have been protected under a program established by former President Barack Obama.
This is consistent with everything the president has talked about, which is prioritizing the people who are here who represent a threat to public safety or have a criminal record. And all this does is lay out the exact procedures to make sure that that subgroup of people who pose a threat to our nation because of a conviction or a violation of public safety or have a criminal record are adjudicated first and foremost. That's it, plain and simple.
Well, the memos are different from Trump's reported new executive order that's coming to temporarily ban travel from seven majority Muslim countries. The original order was blocked by federal courts, and a newly written order is expected this week. Here are some of the stories we're following at VOANews.com. Just 1 month in, the U.S. president and aides are facing multiple investigations. A study finds teen suicide attempts fall after same-sex marriage is made legal. Officials warn the world must do more to protect children from conflict. And U.S. marijuana industry is anxiously awaiting new AG's cannabis position. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, across the United States, more states are enacting laws which allow qualified terminally ill adults to voluntarily request and receive a prescription medication to end their life. Currently, there are five states in the U.S. that have death with dignity laws, and just this week, another went into effect in Washington, D.C. Joining me now for more on this very controversial issue, Peg Sandeen, Executive Director with the Death with Dignity National Center in Portland, Oregon. Thank you for being with us. So this is entirely up to the individual states?
It is absolutely up to state jurisdictions. It is Death with Dignity is about the practice of medicine. And in our country, the practice of medicine is guided by the states.
How many other states are also considering enacting these types of laws?
Right now, 23 states have bills in their legislatures considering death with dignity, so nearly half the country.
And what is the argument in favor of allowing this?
You know, it's all about dignity and autonomy. People want to be able to control how they die. Modern medicine has changed everything about how we die in the last 50 years. With medical technology and medications, our lives have been extended and extended far beyond sort of anything that our grandparents or our great-grandparents would have expected or had available to them. And with that extension of life has become a time that for many people brings with it a lot of suffering. And people really want to be able to say, I've had enough. And that sort of that idea, that change in medicine has really brought about the death with dignity movement in this country.
And I know the issue really sparked a national debate in 2014 after a woman by the name of Brittany Maynard, 29-year-old woman, who had terminal brain cancer, really went public with her decision to end her own life.
Yes, absolutely. She was very, very brave because she wanted to demonstrate to all of America that what was happening to her was patently unfair, that she was forced to move to Oregon when she was dying to take advantage of death with dignity because her home state did not have it.
It's interesting because here in the United States, we don't allow our pets, our animals, to suffer. We humanely euthanize them before it comes to that or if we think they're suffering. Why is it so different when it comes to humans who are actually able to make that conscious choice themselves? Do you actually see this as a human right?
Oh, I do absolutely see this as a human right. I believe that it is imperative that we have the ability to control this very personal moment. We only get one death. And I think that it belong to each of us without government intervention about how it should go.
If someone is in a state where they are allowed to make that choice, how is that usually done?
All of the states that have death with dignity laws, all the five states plus the district just this week, they're all the same. The laws are structured almost identically. And what happens is it's all about your relationship with your physician. So what you do if you're terminally ill and you have a prognosis of 6 months or left to live, is that you go to your doctor and you ask for a prescription to hasten death. And your doctor may choose to participate or not, so your doctor can opt out if he or she doesn't believe in the process. And so say that your doctor does agree, then you'd have to go see a second opinion, which is common in medicine, to make sure that your prognosis and diagnosis qualify you. And you have to do three requests. Two oral and one written. You have to go through some waiting periods. And after you do all of these processes to qualify, then you get a prescription from your physician to hasten death. And what's interesting is that in all of these states where the bill has been enacted, about a third of the people do not ingest the medication to hasten their death. Rather, the medication acts as peace of mind.
Right.
People think, as I've talked to them and come to understand the process, for them, for the folks who don't use the medication, they really feel like, I will take it tomorrow if my symptoms get too bad, but if they're not so bad today, I will live my life and enjoy my family. And so it's that peace of mind.
To have the option.
Right. They have the option.
Is it basically a medication that they just basically go to sleep?
Basically, yes. It's a medication that brings upon death.
No suffering.
No suffering. That's what's written into the law. If you think about what is the core of this law, it's about the end of suffering. And it happens very quickly. Within a minute to 5 minutes, a person is asleep or unconscious and progressing quickly to your death.
Is there any chance that the federal government could intervene in any of these state laws? Or have they tried at all?
Yes, they have many times. We have a couple of Supreme Court decisions that set out the framework for death with dignity. In 1997, the court decided that this was a matter left up to the laboratory of the states. And so that's how we have this state-by-state process that has come to be. And then in 2006, we saw a Supreme Court decision, which was the first case that Chief Justice John Roberts had. And in that decision, the court decided that the federal government could not prosecute Oregon pharmacists and physicians for prescribing. But what they did say in that first 1997 decision was that Congress could either make death with dignity the law of the land or could ban death with dignity across the country. Those decisions have become the rule of law. They have not been challenged, and so we're pretty confident that they will remain the rule of law.
All right. Well, that's very interesting stuff. Thank you for being with us. Peg Sandin, Executive Director with the Death with Dignity National Center in Portland, Oregon. Well, traffic jams are costing U.S. drivers an average of $1,200 a year in wasted fuel and time, and it's even more than that in Los Angeles, a city with the world's biggest rush hour delays. The stats were revealed in a newly released study by Seattle-based company INRIX. VOA's Victor Beatty talks about it with INRIX senior economist Bob Pishu.
The report covers over 1,000 cities in 38 countries. So this is a real expansive report. It looks at congestion at, you know, various times of the day on different roads throughout the day, and really gives us a deep insight into the transportation network going on in all of these cities. The biggest finding was Los Angeles tops the global list, with the typical driver in Los Angeles spending 104 hours sitting in traffic last year.
Is this because sheer volume or lack of roads? What is the primary issue here?
It's a combination of things. Fairly long commute times, congestion during various parts of the day, so through in the peak period especially.
You also mentioned that aside from Los Angeles, the worst stretch of road, according to Reuters in the U.S., is New York City's Cross Bronx Expressway, where drivers on the 7.5-kilometer road spend an average of 86 hours a year staring at the bumper of the car in front of them.
That's right, yeah. So on that stretch of road, if drivers were to take that for every day, 240 commute days, they would have lost 86 hours last year sitting on that road.
Internationally, Moscow drivers had it even worse than those in Los Angeles. They spent 25.2% of their total driving hours on congested roads. Is that just a lack of roads or just the amount of the vehicles?
It could be a combination of both. Traffic congestion really boils down to when the demand for roads exceeds the supply of roads. So if you have factors, you know, like a strong economy, you know, that'll obviously drive travel demand. And if you have a lack of transportation capacity, that will also exacerbate congestion. What we kind of see in Moscow, though, is a general trend of congestion easing, congestion getting less frequent, and it appears that that's due to some economic factors, among other things.
This comes as President Trump has promised at least $1 trillion in infrastructure spending. Is this coming at a good time?
It depends on who you ask. I think all we wanted to do with this report is add to the conversation. This is a new way to look at congestion, a new way to measure, and we hope that public officials, employers, and drivers can all talk about congestion to figure out what projects would deliver the most bang for the buck.
According to the Associated Press, your report indicates that U.S. drivers averaged more than 40 hours a year in traffic during peak times. San Francisco was the fourth most congested city. Bogota, Colombia was fifth. Sao Paulo in Brazil ranked sixth. London, Atlanta, Paris, Miami rounded out the top 10.
What's interesting, being able to look at the data on a really granular level, is some of these cities have a lot in common. Los Angeles, New York, San Francisco, you mentioned, but they have different travel patterns. So, for example, San Francisco is very congested on city streets during the peak commute times, and still fairly congested on the highways during peak periods. Unlike New York, which actually the congestion rate, is how we measure it, on highways during the peak period is actually far lower. What New York suffers from is high congestion on city streets during the peak hours and also during the daytime. It had the highest daytime congestion measured of these U.S. major cities that we looked at.
That's Bob Pishu, senior economist with INRIX, talking to VOA's Victor Beatty. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
I'm Victor Beatty. Since 1942, the Voice of America has been a consistently reliable and authoritative source of news. Today, VOA remains committed to providing an accurate, objective, and comprehensive news product at the top of every hour, every day. We can be heard on your local affiliate,
or streamed on the web at voanews.com.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues now with a look at what's trending on social media. And for that, we're joined by the lovely G. Abby Lee. Hey, G.
Hi, Lori. Let's start in Iceland. Its president made a rather bold statement while speaking to a group of high school students Tuesday. He was taking questions from students when one asked what he thought of pineapple as a pizza topping.
Now, this is an important topic. What did he say?
He said he would pass a ban on pineapple as a pizza topping if he had the power to pass laws on his own. I mean, if you ask me, he is a smart man. While some people are saying we need more politicians like him, others are saying those who don't enjoy pineapple chunks on pizza can all move to Iceland because we don't have good taste.
Okay, well, I'm with him, okay, on this.
You're with me, too.
I'm with you, too. I just believe very strongly that pineapple has no place on pizza.
Yeah.
Nor does any other fruit, for that matter.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Pizza is pizza. Fruit is fruit. Never the two should be fraternizing.
I totally agree because it's savory. You can't mix sweet with savory. Not on pizza. And moving on to another topic, there's a lively discussion on the new Department of Homeland Security priorities. The Trump administration released two memos that detail how the department plans to increase enforcement and deportation of undocumented immigrants. Now, for instance, if you're an undocumented immigrant, even a minor infraction, such as driving without a license, can get you deported. Many Trump supporters are rooting for this development, but those who disagree say mass deportation is not good for America, a country built by immigrants.
Gotcha. Okay. So, well, you mentioned earlier that there's music by Unicorn. What's that about?
So what I meant by that is that a YouTuber made music by arranging musical notes to make out a unicorn. His name is Andrew Huang, and he's on Twitter at AndrewIsMusic. People are wondering, how on earth musical notes arranged to look like unicorn sound so magical? But if you think about it, how can it not? It looks like a unicorn. Lori, back to you.
All right. Thanks so much, as always, G. You can follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Well, popular singer's health and relationship woes seem to be behind her. Here to tell us more is VOA's Border Crossings host, Larry London, who joins International Edition's Sarah Williams.
Today we're going to talk about one of the hottest young female pop stars on the planet. Her name is Selena Gomez. And last week she put out a brand new single from her brand new upcoming album. Last year she put out an album called Revival, and you may recall that she checked herself into rehab. She has an illness called lupus. There's no cure for that. She suffered from anxiety and depression, and so she went into rehab for treatment for that. And spent a few months in the rehab facility, came out, and now she's kind of got a renewed outlook on things. She separated herself from a very toxic relationship she'd had with Justin Bieber, and now she's got a new romance going on with her new boyfriend, who's The Weeknd. He happens to be another pop star in music, and Justin's been very vocal about that, very jealous about that. But nonetheless, she seems in a good place. She's very happy, so she's got a new song. And we're going to check it out right now, and it's called It Ain't Me.
Well, certainly she has two very prominent boyfriends, Justin Bieber, and also The Weeknd. You know, The Weeknd has had at least two pretty big hits.
Huge hits. And he's got a new album, Starboy. In fact, I mentioned Justin Bieber posted an Instagram video of himself saying, "Hey, my new favorite song is Starboy." So obviously he was being very sarcastic and kind of poking fun at Selena's new boyfriend. But that hasn't fazed her at all. You know, she's moving on, moving forward. She's got a new album. She says the new album is going to be dance music. And the new song features Kygo, who's a very well-known EDM producer in the game. It's called It Ain't Me. She also said that she's worked with DJ Snake, who's another EDM producer, on another single. And so we're going to have some new music, a new album, dance music, a kind of a departure from what she's known for. And last year's album was called Revival. She was reinventing herself last year when she put it out. So she's reinventing herself now with her next album. She signed a multi-million dollar deal with Coach Handbags. She's the new celebrity face of Coach Handbags. She's also the face of Pantene Hair Shampoo. And I suspect that she'll be going out on tour as well when the new album comes out later on this year.
All right, thanks a lot, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossings. Who's gonna rock you when the sun won't let you sleep? Who's waking up to drive you home when you're drunk and all alone? Who's gonna walk you through the dark side of the morning?
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Laurie London in Washington. Have yourself a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions. This is one of a series on the U.S. Constitution and the structure of the U.S. government.
In a bid to protect the rights of citizens, the founders of the United States of America included in the Constitution, or the legal framework of the new government, 10 amendments, 3 to protect individual rights and 7 to ensure justice. They are collectively named the Bill of Rights. The Fourth Amendment deals with issues of privacy. It states that the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. Search and seizure of private property by authorities was a major grievance with the framers of the Constitution. This is borne out in the writings of James Otis, Jr., a colonial lawyer in Massachusetts, who argued in court against writs of assistance, used instead of warrants by British officials to enter private homes and businesses to search for evidence of smuggling. Writs never expired and were transferable from one official to another. Arguing before a British court that writs should not be legal, Otis said that with a writ, custom house officers may enter our houses when they please. We are commanded to permit their entry. Their menial servants may enter, may break locks, bars, and everything in their way, and whether they break through malice or revenge, no man, no court can inquire. Bare suspicion without oath is sufficient. Otis lost that case. But his arguments, as well as the memory of the violations of privacy and unreasonable searches suffered by the colonists under the British government, influenced the framers of the Constitution. And thus, the First Amendment to the Constitution to deal with justice took aim at unreasonable search and seizure. As a result, any search, seizure, or arrest requires a judicially sanctioned warrant, which must be supported by probable cause. The warrant is limited in scope by specific information supplied to the issuing court. evidence obtained without a warrant and thus illegally cannot be introduced into a criminal trial. In the words of mid-20th century Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart, at the very core of the Fourth Amendment stands the right of a man to retreat into his own home and there be free from unreasonable governmental intrusion.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
It's full.